Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, this Monday, July 20th, 2026, for our Startups Edition.
Today, we are examining the fundamental decoupling of brand identity from operational scale. We are moving away from an era where market dominance was predicated on sheer headcount and toward a model defined by concentrated, high-leverage expertise.
It is no longer about who you employ, but how you execute.
Exactly.
We begin our analysis with the founder's playbook, looking closely at the intersection of branding, technical mastery, and the management of inevitable crises. Amjad Mossad, the CEO of Replit, famously had to navigate a massive database error back in 2025, and rather than retreating into a dark room, he basically doubled down on the transparency. Today we're looking at the founder's playbook, how branding, storytelling, and even crisis management are being re-engineered as core components of the startup stack.
It's a shift from reactive PR to proactive identity building, where the goal isn't just to manage a reputation, but to use communication as a way to bridge the gap between a visionary dream and a commercial reality.
So what you're saying is that when the revenue isn't there yet, you just narrate yourself into existence.
We can trace that further, because strategic storytelling acts as a necessary meme to stabilize the company during those early stages when you lack the market success to drive recruitment or fundraising through raw metrics alone. You're essentially using a narrative to provide the social proof that the numbers haven't caught up to yet.
It sounds incredibly high stakes. One wrong word and you've gone from visionary to unemployable.
But Mossad argues that the canceled label is actually a misunderstanding of how reputation works in the digital age. He suggests that the only way to truly lose your reputation permanently is to stop participating in the conversation entirely. Cancellation is a reversible state as long as you maintain visibility.
I suppose it's much harder to ignore someone who is actively showing up to apologize for their mistakes.
Right, and that's where the mechanics of building in public come in. You take your internal company updates, the stuff intended for employees or investors, and you transform them into public posts. This creates a feedback loop where the founder gets the reps necessary to develop a public voice without having to invent new content from scratch.
It's like training for a marathon by running through a crowded mall. You get the mileage in, but you might trip over a stroller along the way.
That's why some founders are treating communication as a form of progressive overload. They practice their public leadership while the company is still small and the stakes are relatively low, essentially using periods of low visibility to recover from PR mistakes before the platform scales to a much more high-stakes environment.
And if you're particularly bad at it, I hear there are improv classes for that.
Mossad actually suggests using exposure therapy, like improv, to develop the necessary public speaking skills. But the real skill isn't just about being loud, it's about being strategic. The A16Z show noted that high-impact communication requires couching arguments within active, large-scale debates. If you just post a direct message into the void, you hit the zero-views trap. You have to map your argument to the existing global zeitgeist, like the current industry-wide anxieties regarding token costs, to ensure your voice actually lands.
So you don't just state your opinion, you hijack an existing argument to ensure people are actually listening.
It's about meta-awareness. You look for where the cultural or technical tension is highest, and you position your narrative there. This even extends to how you handle external pressure. For high-profile companies facing regulatory or government scrutiny, you can actually leverage forbidden narratives to create a marketing advantage, where the very fact that a regulator is targeting you becomes a signal of how powerful or disruptive your product actually is.
MA?
That sounds incredibly cheeky. They're trying to ban us because we're too good.
It's a way of turning external opposition into a badge of importance. We see this in the shift toward unfiltered executive communication, where leaders like Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg bypass traditional PR filters to engage directly with their audiences. They're leveraging the growing public craving for unmediated truth to bypass the perceived bias of traditional journalism.
But there's a fine line between being unfiltered and just being unfiltered chaos.
The distinction lies in ownership. When things go wrong, like the Replit database error, the most effective way to manage the crisis is to prioritize ownership and transparency over defensiveness. If you acknowledge a specific technical or operational failure clearly, you can actually transform a PR crisis into a moment of brand reinforcement. You prove that the system is self-correcting.
It's much harder to stay defensive when you've already admitted you messed up.
It's a telling detail. It's about creating a brand that is resilient because it is honest. This authenticity is a powerful tool for recruitment, too. When a founder is building in public, they aren't just selling a product, They are selling the journey, which attracts talent that wants to be part of the unfolding story.
I suppose it's a lot easier to recruit engineers to a work in progress than to a perfectly polished corporate entity that feels like it's hiding something.
And that transparency allows for a much more organic growth of influence. You aren't just a CEO, you are a participant in the larger technical conversation. You are using every mistake, every update, and every debate to reinforce the company's core identity.
It's a high-wire act, though. You're essentially building the tightrope while you're walking on it.
But for the founders who master it, the tightrope becomes the very thing that defines them.
Founders should ensure their internal communication logs are being reviewed for public scalability before they hit send.
We'll be watching for the first time a major regulatory crackdown on a platform actually triggers a measurable surge in user engagement.
But as these founders become more vocal and more public, it raises the question of what happens when the software itself stops needing a human interface to act. I was reading this morning that we might soon reach a point where the most valuable part of a billion-dollar software company is the part you can't actually see. No buttons, no menus, no pretty dashboard, just a pile of silent, invisible logic.
It sounds like a ghost story, but it's actually the roadmap for the next decade of enterprise software. We are moving from UI-centric SaaS, where you pay for a nice interface to click through workflows, to what's being called headless or agentic systems.
Headless? It sounds like a particularly grim way to describe a corporate restructuring.
In this case, it's more about the evaporation of the interface. Think about the traditional way a startup sells to an enterprise. You build a beautiful Salesforce or SAP-style dashboard that makes complex data look manageable. But as Seema Ambel has argued, the value is migrating away from the visual interface and into the underlying data and business logic. If an AI agent can just ping an API to execute a transaction, the pretty part of your software becomes a cost center rather than a selling point.
So if I'm a founder, I shouldn't be spending 6 months perfecting the shade of blue on my submit button.
The data tells a story. If the user is an LLM or an agent, the user doesn't care about your hex codes. They care about the precision of your schema and the reliability of your API. We're seeing this already. Look at the 300% increase in Slack bot usage. People aren't opening the Slack UI to find info. They're just asking a bot, which then pulls data from other headless services.
It's like we're moving from the era of the luxury department store, where the whole point is the window display and the marble floors, to the era of a massive automated warehouse. You don't care if the forklift driver sees a catalog, you just want the pallet to arrive on time.
That's a perfect way to frame it. But for a startup, this transition creates a massive new complexity matrix. The A16Z show noted that we're entering a three-tier hierarchy of difficulty. First, you have lookup functions. These are easy, lightweight, and ripe for automation. Then you have action functions, which are much harder because they introduce massive risks around identity and seat licensing. If an agent executes a trade or signs a contract on your behalf, who is legally responsible? Finally, there's analysis. This is the hardest tier because it requires hallucination verification. You can't just let an agent guess at a financial audit.
And I assume that's where the margin squeeze happens. It's one thing to automate a lookup. It's another to build a system that can double-check its own work without costing a fortune in compute.
And there's a deeper tension in the economics here. The A16Z show highlighted an emerging value capture crisis. We see these massive productivity gains, like automating complex regulatory or satellite data analysis, but those gains aren't actually showing up in the gross margins of the model providers. The cost of inference and the sheer commodity nature of basic intelligence are compressing margins. For a startup, the opportunity isn't in providing the brain, but in providing the nervous system the context.
You mean the stuff that isn't in the official manual?
Something to flag here, you can have the smartest model in the world, but if it doesn't understand the tribal knowledge of a specific company, the unrecorded way a certain client prefers to be handled, it's useless. This is why the integration of context graphs is the next big frontier. You need to move beyond structured CRM data to capture the data exhaust of how work actually happens.
The real moat isn't the code, it's the messy data you've gathered from observing humans being humans.
It's about creating what we call agentic loops. The goal is to build a system that captures benchmark performance, like analyzing which specific communication styles drive higher response rates in different global markets. If your software can learn and optimize itself based on that loop, you've created something much stickier than a simple tool.
It sounds like a nightmare for the traditional software salesperson. How do you demo a loop that lives entirely in a background process?
You don't demo the loop, you demo the outcome. But there is a catch. The A16Z show pointed out that even in a headless world, the UI isn't dead, it's just changing roles. Because humans still need to steer and verify what these agents are doing, the value is shifting to the platform's ability to visualize and facilitate human feedback. The agentic loop actually creates a new kind of product stickiness centered on how well you can help a human supervise an autonomous process.
We aren't getting rid of the dashboard, we're just turning it into a cockpit for a pilot who is mostly on autopilot.
That's exactly it. And for startups, the winners won't be the ones building the best autopilot, but the ones building the best flight controls and the most reliable black box recorders. If you can build a tool that helps a legal team, like Canva's legal department did, to automate a specific high-friction task, saving 1,500 hours a year on trademarking, you've proven the value of the agentic shift. You aren't just providing a feature, you're providing a verifiable, automated workflow.
It's a high-stakes game of don't break the automation.
It is.
If you move too fast and the agent hallucinates a legal clause, the headless advantage evaporates instantly.
Founders need to stop obsessing over front-end aesthetics and start hardening their API logic and data veracity. Keep a close eye on the unit economics of the big router architectures. If the big players successfully trade intelligence for cost efficiency on low-value queries, the window for high-margin, specialized agentic startups might shrink faster than we think. But if the software is moving into the background, we have to wonder about the sheer amount of power and silicon required to keep all those invisible engines running. Alex, if you were a billionaire venture capitalist, would you rather bet on the smartest person in the room, or the person who owns the room, the chairs, and the electricity powering the lights?
Without hesitation, the person owning the utilities. We're seeing a massive structural shift in AI where the battle for dominance is moving away from who can train the most brilliant model and toward who controls the entire physical and digital stack.
The era of the AI researcher in a garage is officially dead, replaced by a high-stakes game of digital real estate and power cables.
Two things stand out. The new frontier isn't just software, it's the massive capital deployment into AI infrastructure. We are seeing an extreme concentration of capital where roughly 30% of all new chips are flowing to just two companies, OpenAI and Anthropic, through providers like Microsoft, Oracle, and CoreWeave.
It sounds less like a tech revolution and more like a construction boom with better branding.
It is a construction boom, but the bottlenecks are becoming physical. Everyone talks about the cost of electricity, but as we've seen in recent discussions, the real bottleneck for US expansion isn't the price of a kilowatt hour. It's the physical difficulty of upgrading the power grid, securing grid interconnection, and finding enough specialized electrical labor to actually plug these clusters in.
Even if you have the money to buy 1,000 GPUs, you're just sitting there with very expensive, very hot paperweights because you can't find a licensed electrician.
Stepping back, in fact, the A16Z show highlighted that the immediate bottleneck isn't even natural gas, but a literal shortage of gas turbines, with a supply backlog estimated at 2 to 3 years. It's a massive logistical logjam.
It's almost funny. We're building these godlike intelligences, but we're being defeated by a shortage of transformers and turbine parts.
The irony is heavy. And while the US struggles with the physical grid, the competition is also moving into a margin compression phase. Hyperscalers like Google and Amazon aren't just trying to build better models. They are using custom silicon, like Google's TPUs, to undercut external chip providers. They are essentially using their captive, in-house supply chains to make it impossible for anyone else to compete on price.
Wait, so if you're a startup trying to build a specialized AI chip, you're essentially trying to outrun a juggernaut that owns the track, the sneakers, and the referee.
You're caught in a design cycle catch-22. As the A16Z show noted, the viability of new silicon startups is undermined because the hardware you design today for current transformer architectures might be obsolete by the time it actually ships, as researchers shift toward more efficient matrix multiplication patterns. To even stand a chance against NVIDIA, a newcomer can't just be slightly better. They need a fivefold leap in efficiency to offset NVIDIA's massive advantages in software, networking, and supply chain.
A fivefold leap. That's not a margin of error, that's a miracle.
It's a massive hurdle. Even NVIDIA isn't immune to the shift. There is a growing move toward router architectures. Look at OpenAI, they are pivoting to a system that automatically directs queries between massive base models, smaller thinking models, and mini models. The goal is to optimize the Pareto frontier of cost per performance. For enterprise users, the priority is shifting from raw intelligence to predictable unit economics. They don't need a PhD-level response for a simple data entry task. They need it to be cheap and reliable.
So the intelligence is being commoditized and the efficiency is the new gold standard.
And that efficiency is being pushed even further by the edge. We're seeing the rise of specialized hyperparameter hardware, like AMD's $4,000 units, that could allow enterprises to run models locally. This could lead to a massive decentralization, potentially breaking the stranglehold that NVIDIA's market dominance relies on. If the ecosystem becomes decentralized through open-source models and easier local deployment, NVIDIA's path to being the world's most valuable company becomes much more precarious.
And let's not forget the all-in strategy from the giants. If NVIDIA has $100 billion in cash coming by the end of 2026, they aren't just going to sit on it.
There's a strong argument that they should pivot into the physical infrastructure layer itself. If they can control the data center and the end-to-end ecosystem, they become untouchable. Even Google is playing a different game. The Tim Ferriss Show noted that Google's advantage is shifting toward a continuous learning architecture, using high-bandwidth chips optimized for constant data flow rather than discrete training cycles. They are aiming for full-stack ownership, chips, data centers, and the distribution layer like Android.
It's a digital feudalism. You either own the infrastructure and the entire ecosystem, or you're just a tenant paying rent to the person who does.
And the rent is getting more expensive. Even with the new U.S. tax policies allowing first-year depreciation on GPU clusters, which provides a massive multi-billion dollar advantage to players like Meta, the capital expenditure is staggering. We're seeing a potential decoupling of spend and revenue, where current investments are effectively accounting for 5 years of projected revenue. If that value capture doesn't materialize, the bubble pops.
Investors should probably start looking closely at the power companies rather than just the software developers.
That would be the pragmatic play.
Infrastructure providers need to prioritize rapid deployment of non-traditional cooling and power solutions to bypass the grid. Keep a close eye on the deployment speed of the next generation of Blackwell-class clusters, because if they hit the same grid bottlenecks as the current ones, the entire investment thesis for the AI era breaks. But as these massive physical assets settle into place, the battle lines are moving beyond the power grid and into the realm of global trade wars and digital borders. Honestly, I think the idea of protecting American tech through export controls is just a polite way of saying we're actively subsidizing our competitors.
That is a massive claim, Maya. You're essentially saying that every time the US government restricts high-end AI chips from reaching the Gulf, they are actually helping China win the global market share.
I'm saying if you block the door, people will just walk through the window. If we keep this up, we'll end up with a world where American software is a luxury good, Chinese hardware is the global standard, and my smart fridge is reporting my breakfast habits directly to a server in Shenzhen.
It's not quite that dramatic, but the mechanism is definitely there. Looking at the recent discussions from Replay 2025, the argument is that these command and control policies create massive pent-up demand. When the US restricts technology to allies, it creates a vacuum. Because the technology is unavailable, those states are driven directly into the Chinese technological ecosystem to find alternatives.
So we create a shortage, which leads to a dependency, which leads to what? The end of Western influence.
The pattern is clear. The way China is playing this is incredibly clever. According to the A16Z show, China is utilizing a commoditization of the complement strategy. They aren't just trying to build a better model. They are leading in open source AI to drive global demand for their hardware scale manufacturing strengths. By making the software free and ubiquitous, they ensure that anyone building an AI ecosystem is eventually forced to use Chinese integrated hardware, like Huawei's cloud matrix networking approach.
Right, because if the software is free, you don't care who made the chips as long as the code runs. It's a Trojan horse made of Python scripts.
It's a way to bypass US chip dominance by using interconnected, less efficient chips to match NVIDIA's system-level performance. And it's not just about hardware, it's about the opinionated nature of the software itself. The A16Z show notes that AI models function as interfaces that project the cultural and ethical values of their creators. If Western models are too restricted or regulated to be used globally, we face cyberspace colonization, where the default logic of the global internet reflects Chinese or non-aligned values instead of democratic ones.
Which sounds great in a white paper, but is actually happening in the regulatory trenches. I see these new algorithmic discrimination laws in California and Colorado, and I wonder if we're just building a legal moat for the big players.
You're touching on a very real phenomenon. The A16Z show highlights that regulatory capture is being driven by established players using fear-mongering as a strategic barrier to entry. Large firms can afford the compliance costs of these complex liability loops, but smaller, more agile startups can't. When a law makes a developer liable for disparate impact, even when the output is factually accurate, it forces them to add a DEI layer that essentially distorts information just to avoid a lawsuit. It kills the very innovation we're trying to protect.
So we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. We either let the big guys regulate us into a corner, or we let the open source models from Beijing take over the global standard.
It's actually forcing a total rethink of the startup lifecycle. The old model was build in Silicon Valley, hit $100 million in revenue, then go international. That is dead. Because of APIs and AI-driven localization, the traditional expansion timeline is collapsing. Startups can now target international markets almost instantly. We're seeing firms like A16Z shift toward a power broker model. Instead of just providing capital, they are using their influence to bridge the gap between portfolio companies, like 11 Labs, and high-level leaders in regions like Saudi Arabia or Mexico.
Like the Flow expansion in Riyadh.
Adam Newman's venture Flow is a perfect case study. They didn't just launch an app, they leveraged the massive demographic shift in Saudi Arabia, targeting the influx of 5 million expected expats by 2030. They transitioned from a foreign entity to a localized Saudi operating company in just 60 days by using flexible software architecture and local leadership. That's not just market entry, that's strategic integration.
It's a shift from selling a product to selling a localized ecosystem.
There's a signal here: if you can capture even a handful of top-heavy companies in a region like North Asia or the Gulf, you gain massive scalable revenue without needing a massive local footprint. The goal is to ensure Western technological standards become the global infrastructure before the vacuum is filled.
Founders in the Middle East need to start looking at localization as a security feature, not just a translation task. Keep an eye on the next wave of US-China hardware trade restrictions. If we see a sudden spike in Saudi or Mexican investment in Huawei-compatible infrastructure, the command and control strategy has officially failed. As we wrap up this edition, the thread connecting everything we've discussed today, from the way founders are now forced to architect their own public narratives to the invisible agentic workflows replacing traditional UIs, is the disappearance of the visible layer. Whether it's the branding of a startup or the interface of a SaaS platform, the surface is becoming secondary to the underlying logic, the data, and the infrastructure that powers it.
So here's the picture. The single most important implication here is for the Series A and B founders currently building wrapper applications. The calculus for these decision makers has fundamentally changed. Your defensibility no longer lives in how intuitive your dashboard is or how much your users love your hex codes, but in how deeply your automated agents are integrated into the physical and regulatory plumbing of the economy. If your value proposition relies on a human-facing interface that can be bypassed by a headless script, you aren't building a company. You're building a temporary feature for someone else's ecosystem. Success now requires mastering the nervous system, the energy grids, the trade compliance, and the proprietary data flows, rather than just perfecting the skin.
It's a shift from designing for eyes to designing for autonomy.
The implication runs deeper, so if you want to know if this thesis is holding, watch the upcoming quarterly earnings and infrastructure reports from CoreWeave and Oracle. Specifically, look for any deviation in their power procurement timelines or hardware deployment velocity. If those expansion plans hit a hard ceiling due to energy or transformer shortages, it will prove that the bottleneck isn't just software intelligence, but the physical reality of the grid, potentially breaking the momentum of this entire agentic shift.
That's all for this week. Thanks for joining us.
We'll see you next Monday.